Welcome to Just Ask, the podcast of the Hive Collective, a digital health platform built to empower women to make educated and informed decisions about their health. I'm your co-host, Dr. Heather Quayle, a leading women's and gender-related nurse practitioner. We provide answers to the questions you may not know how to ask by interviewing experts in nursing, medicine, sexual health, and wellness. We started in 2020 with myself and colleague Dr. Tara Thompson, pharmacist, and now welcome our co-host and leading women's health expert and nurse practitioner, Jackie Piasta. This is a safe space where no question is off limits, and we advocate and encourage listeners to just ask their most intimate questions and to break down the barriers of embarrassment and taboo.
I'm Jackie Piasta, your other co-host and fellow Queen Bee of the Hive. Each month, we bring on a new guest that is an expert and healthcare innovator in their respective field. As the healthcare landscape rapidly evolves, we are excited to be on the cutting edge and have decided to evolve the podcast into the Hive Collective, a space that seeks to equip you to better navigate your health journey. To learn more about our new and exciting platform, check out our mission, vision, values, and initiatives as we discuss our rebrand in Season 4, Episode 1. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram. We're excited you're here and hope you enjoy our show.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to our presentation titled Her Turn, New Market Medications for Female Sexual Health. My name is Tara Thompson. I'm a pharmacist, and I mainly deal in women's health medicine, and I'm here with my colleague today, Heather Quayle.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for attending our lecture. I am Heather Quayle. I'm a women's health nurse practitioner and asex sexuality counselor, as well as a fellow of the International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health, or ISWISH. And I own my own practice, the SHOW Center, which is the Sexual Health Optimization and Wellness Center. Tara and I do so much work together, so it's really nice to have your token pharmacist when you're a provider that you can ask tons of questions when you want to know mechanism of action and all those wonderful things where Tara plays a huge role in my practice help for my patients.
All righty. So both Heather and I do not declare any existence of a financial interest of any amount related to the content of this activity today. Also, we just wanted to disclose that this program does cover some sensitive topics, including common sexual disorders. So if you're in an area that's not conducive to your participation today or around people that you might not want hearing what you're listening to, we just recommend that you rejoin at another time or put in your headphones or something like that. So today we are going to go over the following learning objectives. So we hope that at the conclusion of this activity, you are better able as a provider to define female sexual dysfunction and its constituent sexual health conditions, such as hypoactive sexual desire disorder, to identify commercially available drug products for female sexual health conditions, and we're also going to review the literature on those today, and then also to outline specific counseling points and side effect profiles for these drug products. So let's talk a little bit about women's health. And before we can talk about that, let's mention men's health for a second. So in men's sexual health, a lot of the medications that we prescribe for them, or I'm seeing patients come to me for, has to do with their plumbing or their anatomy. So erectile dysfunction, Peyronie's, premature ejaculation, a lot of these leading or being the cause of low testosterone, for example, and prescribing PDE5 inhibitors, testosterone. So we're treating the sexual health, men's sexual health problem at the level of the plumbing or possibly the hormones. For females, it's a little bit different. So not to mention all of our hormones that are fluctuating throughout each month, or if you're in menopause, just your lack of hormones. But we also have a neurotransmitter component, and men also have this component, but right now it's being studied mainly in women. And those are the medications we're going to be talking about today. And that's at the level of the neurotransmitter. And we'll see the different neurotransmitters later, the excitatory ones and the inhibitory ones, and how all of these play into sexual dysfunctions. This is a really fun statistic that Heather and I got from one of our colleagues in the urology world, but they say that when sex is good, it adds 15 to 20% value to a relationship. But when sex is bad, it actually can drain the relationship of that positive value with about 50 to 70%. So you can see the huge discrepancy there. And this is why women are coming to us and asking for help and asking, is there something to help me? What can I help invigorate my sex life or help my libido? And so that's what we want to share with you guys today.
So as you can see, this is a super important topic to both of us. I've literally created an entire practice around female sexual health. So some of the most common things you're going to see in the primary care world, especially, is you're probably going to treat at least 50% of your patients are going to be women, probably even more for some of you. And female sexual dysfunction is probably going to be one of the most complex things that you see. And so I like to kind of look at this little scenario that I give my patients, and I compare it to a cockpit and a light switch. I usually say that men are the light switch, on off. Just like Tara said, it's like plumbing. It's easy to turn them on, turn them off. No pun intended on that. And females are very much like a cockpit. When you think about the neurotransmitters in our brain, the serotonin, the norepinephrine, the dopamine, all those different things interplaying, think about a cockpit, multiple switches, multiple things going on. It's all brain, psych, physical, spiritual, all those pieces combined with the female. So it's not quite so simple. Usually when we talk about female sexual dysfunction, we're going to see different categories. Most common is usually going to be this hypoactive sexual desire disorder, or HSDD, which I'll define in just a second, as well as FSAD, female sexual arousal disorder. And then there could be orgasmic disorders as well as sexual pain disorders. Let me dive into the one that you're going to see the most likely in your practice is going to be usually that HSDD, or hypoactive sexual desire disorder. And really what it is it's a loss of a desire to initiate or participate in sexual activity. And it includes behavioral responses, things such as an avoidance of situations that could lead to sexual activity, meaning that they may cause you distress. There's a lack of motivation for sexual activity as either manifested by reduced or absence of spontaneous desire, so sexual thoughts and sexual fantasies, or there's also a reduced or absent responsive desire to things such as erotic cues and stimulation, or inability to maintain desire. Oftentimes, I will tell my patients when there is something going on here, it's not a problem if you're like, yeah, I'm in a relationship. My partner's not interested in sex. Neither am I. It doesn't bother me. It doesn't bother the partner. Okay, then really there's not a diagnosis there. But if it's something that is distressing to you, distressing to the relationship, distressing to your partner, then you actually have a diagnosis of HSDD. And as you can see with the ICD-9, for coding purposes, is F52.0. When we dive into the female sexual arousal disorder, that is going to be either lifelong or acquired, and it can range for something from mild to severe, and it may be generalized or situational, and there's currently no precise measures of prevalence of this. And so one survey of U.S. women found that about 12% of women reported experiencing a personally distressing sexual problem in relation to their arousal. So the inability to either maintain achieving an orgasm or an arousal response or excitement, those all kind of fall into this female sexual dysfunction category. And these are going to be the more common ones that you're going to see. So when we talk about female sexual response, I always like to kind of go back to my Venn diagrams. And it is, you're going to hear me say, if you follow me on any kind of things, it's a biopsychosocial approach. It involves biology, psychology, sociocultural, and interpersonal. We often will hear women say, you know, they all told me it was in my head, go drink some wine and you'll be fine. I'm not going to take away that there's not some form of a brain response when there is a female sexual response. Of course there is. And of course it's in our heads when we think about those neurotransmitters, but there's also lots of other parts and pieces. It's a spiritual, a body, a psychological, and interpersonal response. I always say to my patients,
sleep, sex. When you look at it, what's going to win? Sleep's always going to win that equation. I'm always going to go to sleep before I have sex with my partner because I am tired and I need it to function. And so again, that's kind of that interpersonal or that psychological battle. Sometimes we think of women and we're like, oh my gosh, we're really not good like men at compartmentalizing. They, like I said, go back to that light switch, turn it on, turn it off. Yes, I want sex. No, I don't. Us as females, we take on so many different things. Oh, but there's dirty dishes in the sink. Oh, my kids are going to hear something. Oh, it's summer. Kids are home on vacation. I can't have sex. So it involves a multifaceted approach. So when you come to this with your patients, I really encourage you to not just say it's in their head and help dive into a little bit deeper. What's going on in the relationships? What's going on at work? What's going on physically in your body? Are there other physical and other comorbidities, diabetes, hypertension, and other things which can be leading to that as well?
Absolutely. So we talk a lot about the neurotransmitters. So let's dive more into this component, because this is one of the components that we're going to be looking at today with the pharmacology piece of this that we're going to go over. And the neurotransmitters, for when it comes to sexual health for females and for males too, but today for females, there is this balance that's going on. Pretend that there's a scale. And on one side, you have excitation, and one side, you have inhibition. And there are different transmitters, neurotransmitters, that are balancing this scale. And so some people may have more of one and less of the other, causing an imbalance. So some of those excitatory neurotransmitters that we know and have been defined as excitatory are dopamine, oxytocin, melanocortins, vasopressin, and norepinephrine. So those are on one side of the scale. And those are in a psychosocial interpersonal realm, those are helping with intimacy, with shared values, with romance, with your behaviors, sexual behaviors, all leading to that excitation phase. On the other side of the scale that we don't like right now, but it happens, is your inhibition side. And there you find your serotonins, your opioids, your endocannabinoids. And those are all but some of the things that we attribute to the inhibition side are relationship conflicts, negative stress, negative beliefs about sex, experiences and negative behaviors towards sex. So you can see on that scale when you have an increase in one or a decrease of the other. And I'll go ahead and go to the next slide because I don't know, I just balanced it a little bit out. You can see a rise in excitation or inhibition. So what we're doing with a lot of these medications that are on the market now is we're either trying to A, increase the excitatory neurotransmitters, or B, block some of those inhibitory neurotransmitters to bring that side of the scale down and the excitatory side of the scale up. Because for a lot of women, it is a neurotransmitter imbalance. And so that if that is what you find is the reason for your patient having these, you've excluded and you've deduced that according to the biopsychosocial model, you've helped with all these other problems or different pieces of that Venn diagram, and you're coming down to this could be a neurotransmitter issue, then you're looking at these specific neurotransmitters, and those are the medications that we're going to be talking about today. And each of these neurotransmitters have different sort of mechanisms of action in the brain when it comes to sexual behaviors. Dopamine and norepinephrine play a critical role in sexual excitation. Norepinephrine plays a stimulating role in sexual arousal, and dopamine plays a role in boosting your desire. Whereas on the other side, serotonin actually increases sexual satiety. It's a sexual satiety signal. It's telling you you're good, you don't need any more sex, you're full. And it actually inhibits arousal. And of course, we always have to remember the hormones and everything in here as well. So we're just looking at a complete picture, a complete biopsychosocial model. But today we're going to be talking about specifically neurotransmitters. So I guess to understand the brevity or the gravity of how prevalent of a problem this is, we want to show a couple slides showing prevalence of female sexual dysfunction. So this actually affects 41% of premenopausal women around the globe. That's huge. So regardless whether you like it or not, I think you're going to have women coming into your practices or your clinics or your offices and telling you, this is something I need help with. 12%, so one in every eight women, have a sexual problem that's associated with interpersonal distress, personal or interpersonal distress. And then the estimated prevalence of female sexual dysfunction in its domains, what Heather talked a little bit about earlier, that HSDD, female sexual arousal disorder, those are estimated prevalence rates worldwide. So very, very interesting to know. Also, women with HSDD are 8 to 10 times more likely than women with normal desire to report feeling unhappy, disappointed, frustrated, ashamed, bitter. So not only are you fixing their sexual health problem or their sexual libido desire issue, you're also fixing so many other mood conditions that they're having. So just to keep in mind of the bigger picture.
So I'm going to kind of talk about the different kind of studies that looked at this. 43% of US women have experienced some form of a sexual problem. So that's pretty big, you know, I mean, that's almost half of women. And again, half of the patients you're going to see are at least women, if not more, and almost half of those patients that you're seeing have had some sort of sexual problem in their life. So let's talk a little bit about this PRESIDE study, which is the prevalence of female sexual problems associated with distress and determinants of treatment seeking study. It was a pretty big study. As you can see, it had a population of over 31,000 females in it. I want to say they put it out there to 50,000, but what they got response from was about 31,000. So a pretty significant study. And what it showed is that it occurs in women, and the women that it studied was those who were 18 and older. So some of the facts that came out of the PRESIDE study, which we call it, was that 43% of women have experienced some sort of sexual problem, which you just heard me say. And the sexual problem is going to be defined as a presence of any of the three of these problems. So desire, arousal, and orgasm. And then sexual pain in this actual study was not assessed because a physical exam would have been required to evaluate if there was any kind of dyspareunia or pain with sex. And they didn't look at that. So it was more answering based on the female sexual distress scale, as well as using the changes in sexual functioning questionnaire, the CSFQ or the FSDS. So the sexual pain wasn't looked at, but in the same study, the following percentages of women were distressed about a sexual problem: 9.5% for low desire, 5.1% for low arousal, and 4.6% for difficulties with orgasm. So again, very significant and something that you will definitely see in your patients. So the other study that we looked at, that was looked at as well in a survey, it was a survey by Liebem and colleagues, was the WISHES study, or the Women's International Study on the Health and Sexuality, or WISHES. And it was a cross-sectional survey, and it had a population of around 952 US women between 20 to 70 with varying reproductive status. And it was conducted in 2000. And what that showed is that for women 20 to 49 years old with decreased sexual desire and distress who were perimenopausal and surgically postmenopausal, the prevalence was about 14% and 26% respectively of some form of sexual desire and distress. The percentage of the surgically menopause women, which was in that 20 to 49 years old with decreased desire and distress, was significantly greater than the percentage of just the premenopausal women, 26% versus the 14%. For the women 50 to 70 years old who were naturally postmenopausal and surgically postmenopausal, the prevalence rates were 19 and 14 respectively. So the objective of that, this particular study, was again to determine the prevalence of the decreased sexual desire and the distress among US women. It was not determined whether decreased sexual desire with distress was primary or secondary to other illnesses, as you kind of heard me talk about in the past. Are there other comorbidities that may exist there? And again, what it showed is that sexual problems and complaints were associated, again, like Tara said earlier on, with low physical and emotional satisfaction with sexual partners and low general happiness. So really important things to see in there as well. And then the last prevalence again was the HSDD registry. And it's significant. Really the most significant thing that I want you to take out of this is that there was clinical significance, but no one saw formal healthcare for it. So 15% of 1,500 women, 1,000 premenopausal and 500 postmenopausal with clinically diagnosed HSDD. So there was a combination of lubrication and arousal disorders for these type of patients. As you can see, 46% on the lubrication, 52% had some sort of arousal disorder. And over half of them, 53%, did not seek formal health care for this. And 36% remained untreated. So again, a huge problem. And a lot of times, one of the biggest things that I find that patients come and tell me is either they're afraid to bring it up, there's not enough time in insurance-based models to bring it up, or they're brushed off by their healthcare provider because they haven't had the knowledge or the skill set that they may even feel comfortable coming and talking about this issue with their patients. And so that's why it's so important that Tara and I felt to get this information out there on ways that you can help your patients, even in a primary care setting. If it gets to a point where it becomes more complicated for you, of course, refer them. But these are simple medicines that we're going to talk to you today that you can do very easily in the primary care setting, especially around HSDD.
So I just wanted to quickly note this slide here. You may have seen it before. It was by Mary Basson, and it's the female sexual response cycle. So at first we thought this was a linear progression. There was a linear progression of female sexual response. So they had desire, then arousal, then satisfaction. But now we found that it's more of a cyclical model. It has many factors. People can come in and out at any point during the cycle. And it's one of the, I guess when you're trying to treat desire or arousal or orgasm, just you have to sort of think of it as a cyclical thing. It's not a linear where one thing happens after the other, but it's all happening at the same time. So just something to keep in mind. I also just wanted to quickly talk about the different measures that are out there for measuring sexual function. Probably the most studied and the most used is the FSFI. It's very quick. It's very easy. It looks at desire, arousal, orgasm, and pain. And there's a link there. There's a PDF that you can do. You can give your patient, and then you have a scoring sheet and that type of thing. Another is the FSDS, which is the female sexual distress scale, which looks more at distress if it's causing them sorts of distress from their sexual functions. And then another one is the DSDS, which is a decreased sexual desire screener. And this is a diagnostic tool. It's very quick, and it's used specifically to look at hypoactive sexual desire disorder. So we'll see on this slide, this is kind of, I just wanted to screenshot some of the DSDS up here. And it's really simple, five simple questions you are asking your patient or having them check off. And if your patient checks off no to 1 through 4, then it's not generalized acquired HSDD. So if there's a no to these, it's not HSDD. If there's a yes to 1 through 4 and a no to 5 on number 5, then you have to sort of use your best judgment to confirm a diagnosis of HSDD. So you want to look first and foremost if the no's are checked off or if the yes's are checked off, and then move on to question 5. On question 5, if you have yeses to 1 through 4 and yeses to any of the 5 factors, then you could better determine your diagnosis for HSDD there. So just a quick overview of that. And then the FSFI was created, like we talked about earlier, to evaluate sexual functioning in women. It has 19 questions, so a little bit different than the DSDS, but there's actually a quantitative score, so you get points in each area, and then you have a score sheet, and you can kind of see where that patient falls, and then what's causing them their most sexual function, their most sexual issues, arousal, pain, desire, that kind of thing. So let's get into the meat and potatoes of why we're here. We said all of those things just to kind of lay the background and stress the importance of the fact that we need to have options and medications for our patients who are coming in and asking us about these issues. So we're going to go over the following medications today. These are available commercially with the exception of testosterone. It is not FDA approved for women right now. There are great studies out there. So we're hoping in the future that it's heading that way, but I do have to disclose that that is not FDA approved option, but we still want to cover it briefly in a slide just to let you know that it's out there and you may see patients come in on it. So let's get started here. Oh, before we get started with the first drug. So here are some of the approaches that we look at when we are looking to help with sexual desire. So there are different ways we can do it. The first, and I sort of go through these modalities one at a time and making sure that they're, you know, either corrected or treated or being properly assessed in a patient. And the first is to increase androgens. So we're talking about their testosterone levels, their hormone levels that can sometimes affect your low desire. We want to increase dopamine. We want to increase norepinephrine, modulate serotonin, and then look at the melanocortins and potentially increase those. Remember our excitatory neurotransmitters over on that left side of the balance. We're trying to increase those things or inhibit the inhibitory side. So if we stop the inhibitory side, we'll ultimately increase the excitatory side. And I will pass it to Heather to go over our first medication.
So I'm going to caveat one little thing Tara said, and she'll probably discuss it in testosterone, but I want to make sure that I point this out to you as well. It may be on her slide, but she mentioned that it was off label and we're going to talk about that. But I also want to make sure that we refer you to the HSDD consensus guidelines that were put out by many different organizations, ISWISH, NAMS, for the use of it. So yes, it's off label, but there's some phenomenal studies that are out there that'll help guide your practice. I didn't want to forget to include that. So that was my little tangent. All right, let's jump into one of my favorites, the little pink pill, flibanserin. And we're going to kind of talk about this and what this looks like. It was started as a recommended dose of 100 milligrams, and I give it to my patients at bedtime. And my reasoning in the bedtime dosage of it is because it's best if it's administered with food. So usually I will tell my patients to make sure that they are taking their flibanserin, usually when they're going to bed or just a couple, like a little bit before bedtime, their tummies are full, they've had their dinner, because food's going to help increase the systemic absorption of it. It shouldn't be taken in the daytime because some of the big side effects with the flibanserin that we're going to talk about will be things such as risk of hypotension, somnolence, syncope, and some nausea. Biggest side effect I see with my patients is the nausea. Usually goes away in the first couple of weeks with it. And so an adequate treatment of flibanserin is going to take most patients about 8 weeks to notice a difference. I usually will tell my patients between 8 and 12 weeks. And the good news is if they don't see results with it causing more sexual thoughts, desire increase, then they don't have to continue on the medicine because it's likely not going to work for them. You've probably heard of flibanserin because you always heard the alcohol warnings with it. And the good news is they've been removed. So it makes it a much easier drug to give to your patients. And usually what I tell my patients in terms of flibanserin is just to make sure that if they do have alcohol, make sure it's at least been 2 hours and no more than 2 to 3 drinks in that 2 hour time frame. And if they have had that, or it's been greater than less than 2 hours and they want to go to sleep, just have them skip their dose for that day and they can restart it back up the next day. So when we look at the history of the flibanserin, you can kind of see it went to the FDA. They said no on the drug. Then it went back to them. It's been this back and forth for quite a bit of time. But what it was a drug that was initially looked at for the treatment of depression, but it actually did not show an efficacy greater than placebo in the phase 2 clinical trials. But during those trials, it was noticed that there was no associated symptoms of sexual dysfunction, and it was actually shown to have a positive effect on sexual desire using the validated instruments, the FSFI, the DSDS that Tara has referred to. And so what that has shown is, what's going on in the brain with it? So I will tell you, if you think about, because this was a medicine that was brought in for the treatment of depression, I actually use it with some of the SSRIs that are out there. Because if you think about what Tara started this entire lecture about, is talking about all our different neurotransmitters. And so what I find in my patient population is that a lot of the SSRIs that exist out there cause issues with libido and just kind of that flat affect around sex and desire. And so adding flibanserin in as a caveat to kind of balance some of those out, because it doesn't show a decrease in desire, it's been really helpful for a lot of patients on that. But you can see it had gone through quite a significant amount of back and forth. So let's talk about kind of the mechanism of action. So this is kind of like a lengthy, this meat and potatoes of the pharmacology behind this. So the mechanism of action is not well elicited in female sexual arousal disorder, but flibanserin exerts a regional selectivity for serotonin receptors in the central nervous system. So it kind of acts as an agonist and an antagonist. It exerts greater selectivity among the postsynaptic 5-HT1 receptors and an agonist against the HT1A postsynaptic receptors. So it has these downstream effects in altering levels of other neurotransmitters and monoamines, such as like your dopamine and things of that nature. When it's combined with a 5-HT2A antagonism, it causes chronic treatment with flibanserin. It boosts up the levels of the dopamine in the mesiocortical area of the prefrontal cortex. And then it also produces a net increase in norepinephrine concentrations selectively in the prefrontal cortex. So we don't have this slide on there, but one of the things that when I talk about flibanserin is there are some wonderful MRIs of the brain and what the brain looks like with someone with HSDD. And where it shows is that there is less of this postsynaptic activity going on in that prefrontal cortex on these patients that have low levels of desire. And so that is where the flibanserin really kind of comes in and helps with this. So both the dopamine and the norepinephrine play a very critical role in sexual excitation, with norepinephrine playing a stimulating role in sexual arousal and dopamine playing a role in boosting desire. Flibanserin does not alter dopamine neurotransmission within the nucleus, and thus no abusive properties are seen with flibanserin. In addition, flibanserin reduces concentrations of serotonin in the prefrontal cortex with chronic administration. So like other monoamines, and I probably just botched that word, sorry, Tara, serotonin modulates sexual activity in an inhibitory fashion through downstream decreases in the dopamine release in the prefrontal cortex. So again, what we're seeing is it's not a female Viagra. I don't want you to think about it that way. It doesn't enhance this selective performance. Currently, it's not approved for the postmenopausal woman, but there is studies out there. It's not approved in men, but again, there's studies that are out there. But what it does is it works on the central nervous system. So a really wonderful drug. And again, to think about with using with SSRIs. So it's metabolized primarily by the C1P3A4 and the lesser extent by the C1P2C19. It has a mean terminal half-life of approximately 11 hours. It was originally, as you heard me say, developed for the treatment of depression, but it didn't show efficacy in those phase 2 clinical trials. Again, it showed no sexual dysfunction. And so again, it showed a positive effect on sexual desire using those validated measures. So it was FDA approved dose was for that premenopausal women with generalized acquired hyposexual desire disorder, or HSDD, 100 milligrams at nighttime for it. The half-life is increased to 26 hours, and the area under the curve is increased 4.5-fold in patients with any kind of mild hepatic impairment. So due to those marked elevations and concentrations in patients with hepatic insufficiency, flibanserin should not be used in patients that have any kind of hepatic impairment. Blavansirin concentrations are slightly increased in mild to moderate renal impairment by a 1.1 fold and in severe impairment by a 1.2 fold. Blavansirin metabolites are primarily eliminated into the urine about 44% and in feces about 51%. So again, the contraindications, as you've heard me say, are going to be those patients that have hepatic impairment or use of moderate or strong CYP3A4 inhibitors. So those are going to be things such as your HIV drugs, your PEPs and your PrEPs. If you think about those antifungals, your antibiotics like Cipro and your macrolides, verapamil, nifazidone, and things of that nature. Again, you really want to make sure that you're careful with those patients that have a history of hypotension and syncope, and especially when it happens around alcohol, because it has been shown to lower blood pressure in these patients, as well as letting your patients, again, it's really important to talk about the nausea side effects with it. Usually it goes away for most patients in that 1 to 2 weeks of getting used to that medicine. But again, you may want to think about giving your patients some form of anti-nausea medicine when they take it. I've been known to do that with some of my patients and a lot of patient education. And then again, like you heard me say, avoiding in patients that may have some of that liver impairment. So when we look at the adverse events with this, again, the biggest ones that you're going to see is going that led to the discontinuation are going to be a lot of that dizziness, the somnolence, and the nausea. Adverse reactions that lead to it is in about less than 1% of the patients that are taking it. The higher incidence, it's a little bit higher of an incidence than the placebo, but most of it was due to those symptoms, again, like I had shown with the increases of the dizziness, the somnolence, the nausea, the fatigue. Again, reminding them they can get some dry mouth, some constipation, all of those issues with it as well. In terms of the alcohol warning, again, some of you are probably remembering a lot of those REMS studies, but the wonderful news is those have gone away. And usually what I tell patients, again, with this is no more than 2 to 3 drinks in a nighttime. And if you do have 2 to 3, just avoid your flibanserin dose for that evening. And if it has been within a 2-hour time frame of having your alcohol, again, just to make sure that it's been that long. And if not, just skip your dose for the night. Again, you want to make sure that if you're taking certain medicines or any kind of liver problems, again, or things that are metabolized by the liver, you want to make sure that you're really careful with your flibanserin dosing. If you tend to feel lightheaded, dizzy, or when you lie down, those are all things that you want to make sure that you're teaching your patients and having them reach back out to you. Increase in drowsiness following administration, again, is one of the most common things. And so what I tell my patients is at nighttime, a lot of my patients that see me are already having maybe some of those peri or premenopausal symptoms, just not sleeping so well. And so they like it because it does help with the sleep factor and gets them so that it makes them a little bit more drowsy. And some off-label things I see with the flibanserin is some of my patients have about a five pound weight loss on it. So they tend to do pretty well with it. I'm going to dive real quickly into the clinical trials, and it looked at the efficacy and safety for the flibanserin, and it was established pretty well in 3 different clinical trials. It looked at a 24-week randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trials, and they named them after the flowers, the violet, the daisy, and the begonia. The women that were enrolled in these studies, again, were premenopausal women with acquired generalized HSDD for at least 6 months. So people that were distressed about this, that it was causing a problem for them or in their relationship with their partner. Most of them were Caucasian. The mean age was 36 and the mean duration of HSDD was 5 years. And in addition, the mean duration in a monogamous relationship was 11 years. On a side note, the relationships were all heterosexual because the FSFI was used as a screening tool and it hasn't been validated yet in same-sex relationships. And again, this study hasn't been evaluated in men and different things or in that postmenopausal patient. So take this into thinking just that premenopausal patient, but the studies found that taking the flibanserin obviously caused an increase in sexual desire, decrease in sexual stress, and it also increased in the number of SSEs, or what we call them is sexually satisfying events. So what is an SSE? It's the number of monthly satisfying sexual events. Women indicated daily if they had experienced a sexual event, and if the sexual event occurred, what was the primary endpoint? Was it the sex satisfying for you? And is standardized to a 28-day period. And the total monthly count of the SSEs was 28 times the sum or the number of the SSEs. So what they asked them is, did you have a sexual event, which could have included sexual intercourse, which is penetrative. Again, this was in heterosexual patients. So penis and vagina, penetrative intercourse, oral sex, masturbation, or genital stimulation by the partner. And was it satisfying to you? Was it gratifying, fulfilling, satisfactory, or successful? So irrespective of whether or not they had an orgasm or whether the event was satisfying to their partner. Again, one of the biggest things being an ASEC counselor has showed to me is that you can have a sexually satisfying event as a female, and it doesn't have to end in an orgasm for a female. I'll even go as so far as to say it may not have to end that way for males, though we've been trained to think that way in society. So again, this looked at, was it satisfying for the female patient? So what it showed in the FSFI is that you can see flibanserin at the top in the light gray, is that there was a statistical significance in all the domains. So in arousal and in desire and in lubrication, is that flibanserin showed that it was statistically significant. The next slide is actually going to show that flibanserin is in the gray and it's actually lower. This is what you want to see. It showed a reduction in distressing low desire. So 25% in reduction in distress was associated with the low desire. So when these patients were taking the flibanserin, they noticed that they were less distressed and less worried about the low desire for the whole reason why they started the medicine. And then in the clinical trials, again, what this looked like was there was an improvement in daily desire, though it was not statistically significant. The FSFI and the daily desire scales, there was a higher number, which was showing that there was that it was equal to the greater sexual desire. And then the distress scale also showed that there was greater distress for these patients as well. And now I'm going to let Chera jump into the next drug that we're going to talk about for, other purposes of hypoactive sexual desire.
All right. So the next one we're going to look at is bremelanotide. We're still going to be talking about the neurotransmitters, but this one targets a different neurotransmitter, still on the excitatory side. So Heather talked a little bit about with flibanserin being talking about norepinephrine and serotonin and dopamine, it kind of has effects on all of those. But today we're going to be talking about the melanocortins when it comes to bremelanotide and what that looks like. So bremelanotide, also known by the brand name Vyleesi, is indicated for the treatment of premenopausal women with acquired generalized hypoactive sexual desire disorder. Again, with the causing marked distress. Distress has been a buzzword today because that kind of defines hypoactive sexual desire disorder for a diagnosis, but is not due to any of these other conditions. So they don't have a coexisting medical or psychiatric condition. There's no problems in the relationship, and it's not due to the effect of a medication or drug. So it's important to rule those things out first before prescribing. Vyleesi or bremelanotide is a little bit different. So this is a on-demand subcutaneous injectable. It was FDA approved in May of 2019. It is an auto injector. It's a one-time use 45 minutes prior to sexual activity. You can use it any time of the day. It has a suggested limit of 8 or less doses per month, and no more than once every 24 hours. So you do have a couple of limitations there. And it is stored at room temperature. It is the second female libido drug to gain FDA approval after flibanserin, which Heather just talked about. Its history is through AMAG Pharmaceuticals. And is first described, it's a peptide, PT-141, first described in literature in 2003. So pretty new drug And we'll see some of the mechanism of actions here. So bremelanotide actually works at the melanocortin. It's a melanocortin receptor agonist, specifically at MCR4. It is a synthetic peptide of alpha melanocyte stimulating hormone. And what it does is it increases the release of dopamine in the synapse. So it actually works at the melanocortin receptor to increase dopamine in the synapse. Remember on that excitatory balance, excitatory inhibitory, dopamine was on the excitatory side. So we are actually using a melanocortin receptor agonist to increase dopamine in the synapse, as you can see on the right picture of patients treated with HSDD with bremelanotide. It gets to peak plasma concentration in approximately 1 hour. So very quick acting. That's why you use it 45 minutes prior to activity. It's 100% bioavailable. That's huge. That's a big deal. It's definitely different than an oral dosage form that Heather talked about and some other ones that are out there. So you're getting all of your drug. And then you can see some elimination and half-life here. Half-life, importantly, is 2.7 hours. So that's important for us to know as pharmacologists, for me, for example, because I can let the patient know in 2 days from now when she's asking me, I think it's still in my system. I'm like, it's not. It was out by half in 2.7 hours after you first injected. So it's good for us to know for counseling points. Some of the adverse events and interactions that are most common are nausea, flushing, injection site reactions, headache, and vomiting. So I know nausea being a big one that sort of got the biggest percentage versus placebo. I know that some providers also prescribe concomitant ondansetron on the side or like a quick acting anti-nausea medication to help with that. I've also heard pyridoxine, which is just a B vitamin that's over the counter, can also be recommended as well to help with the nausea. The only contraindication to bremelanotide injections are uncontrolled hypertension or known cardiovascular diseases. And you just want to warn patients about a transient increase, so a quick increase in blood pressure and decrease in heart rate that could occur. Also, because interesting fact, it does work at the melanocortin receptor. It can increase your melanin in your cells, your melanocytes in your cells. So there could be some focal hyperpigmentation. People think, oh yay, I'm going to get a tan. I'm like, not really. It's not really a tan. It's more like on your elbows and knees. I haven't seen it happen in person, but I know that that could be a side effect just because of the mechanism of action. And I know it's been seen in the trials too. So some of the studies that they looked at, the main one being the ReConnect study, very interesting. They did a 24-week double-blind placebo-controlled core study. It had a 52-week extension on it. And basically, they looked at over 1,200 women with HSDD with an average age of 39. You guys are probably thinking, this sounds just like the flibanserin trials, but very similar patient population group, mostly Caucasian, mean duration of 4 years. And they looked at a couple different primary endpoints. So we'll look at those now. The first one being they looked at an increase in sexual desire. So they did look at that FSFI score from baseline to the end of the study. And you can see here with the bremelanotide on the top, having a statistically significant difference, a 2.6 increase in desire versus placebo. So that was one of the endpoints. Another endpoint was they looked at distress and they found a significant decrease in distress, which is good. We want a decrease in distress, statistically significant versus placebo by 1.75 times less distress than those who were on placebo. So that's huge for women. Not only do we want desire, but we do not want to be stressed about it causes our relationship or our mental state distress. Some of the, Heather talked a lot earlier about the sexually satisfying events or sexually satisfying encounters. There was no statistically significant difference between the patients in the placebo and then the sexually satisfying or satisfying sexual events in this particular trial. But then they came out and said, well, the FDA no longer requires the number of SSDs to be a co-primary endpoint in trials because it's not part of the diagnosis of HSDD. So they kind of like threw that one out. But because it's not a part of the diagnosis, they didn't find it to be important, as important of a co-primary endpoint, and didn't include it in there. So I want to talk a little bit. So that was really quick over bremelanotide, but I want to get to these just off label, or these next ones, just so you guys have a broad overview of everything that we're looking at for our patients and can make the best informed decision. One of the other ones is bupropion, and bupropion works as a norepinephrine dopamine reuptake inhibitor. So it inhibits the reuptake of dopamine and norepinephrine in the synapse. So we want to keep these two neurotransmitters in the synapse. These are two neurotransmitters on that excitatory side that we want elevated. We want to keep in the synapse so the patient can use them for their sexual, excitatory sexual side of that balance. And they do have pro-sexual effects, both of them. In a double-blind placebo-controlled study, bupropion showed improved measures of sexual arousal, orgasm completion, and sexual satisfaction. And then, of course, desire as well, but it wasn't statistically significant in desire. Bupropion may benefit premenopausal women. All these medications were studied first in premenopausal women. That's their core study group that they look at first, is premenopausal women. And then if it passes or if it has good effects in premenopausal, they'll take it out to other populations, like Heather was talking about, postmenopausal women, men, same-sex relationships, which are very, very important too. But right now we're so early in learning about these drugs that we're just getting that premenopausal indication. And there's your dosing there if you want to see. So testosterone, like Heather mentioned, we did want to talk about it. There are some amazing, amazing trials. One that just came out last year, fantastic for topical testosterone for women, and its effects on HSDD and desire and libido and all of that. So right now it is not FDA approved for that, but we're hoping to seek indication for that. There is only evidence-based indication at this point. In the past, they had looked at like a patch and a gel and those kind of things, but they did not receive FDA approval. There is approval for these drugs in other countries. So I hope that, you know, the US is getting there. Some other prescription options. When we talk about sexual health, we can never leave out pain, sexual pain, vaginal atrophy, atrophic vaginitis, and those types of things. So that's a whole nother lecture that we could give and take a whole nother of your hour to talk all about the other sexual health conditions for women when it comes to below the belt. But I'll just quickly throw this slide up there so that you guys can see there are some other drugs out there. Ospimifene is FDA approved as a selective estrogen receptor modulator to help with that vaginal pain atrophy. DHEA or prasterone is FDA approved for dyspareunia, vaginal pain. It is a vaginal suppository. And then of course you have your estrogen products containing estradiol, which are your local vaginal estrogens thought to build up that vaginal mucosa for vaginal atrophy.
And just like Tara said, we really can't dive into a whole lot of vaginal pain and GSM or genitourinary symptom of menopause. It could be its own lecture in and of itself. But I think that with getting into a conversation around female sexual health and not talking about GSM would be a failure on our part. Since about 2018, there were about six different surveys on women that looked at the impact of GSM, the Reveal, the Viva, the Closer, and the Revive. And again, it really showed consistent findings of the negative impact that GSM has, especially GSM symptoms affect at least 50% of that postmenopausal woman. The prevalence increases with that postmenopausal stage of that patient. It's chronic, it's progressive. They're not going to improve improve without treatment. If one of the most important things I can impart on you that one of my dear, dear colleagues says is that you should be giving all of your menopausal patients some form of vaginal help, especially if they are in a sexual relationship, until death do they part. And so they should be on some form of, whether it's going to be a vaginal estrogen, which we can dive into again on its own other level, very little, if any, systemic absorption. So you may have to go back and talk to your breast oncologist and work with them, but these patients need it. There's going to be less risk of urinary tract infections, problems, dryness. If you have a patient that is consistently coming to you in their postmenopausal years complaining of frequent chronic urinary tract infections, the first thing you should be thinking of is GSM, and that they need to be on some form of a vaginal product, whether it's a moisturizer, a hyaluronic acid, an estrogen, or something to that. I could go on and on GSM, but we would be a failure to not at least mention this, because it greatly impacts sexual health.
Absolutely. I 100% agree with Heather. I just want to put these slides there for your edification. You're going to get a copy of these if you don't have it already. And I just want you to have them in front of you if you have that patient who maybe comes in on this medication, or they mention it. That way you can like flip back and look really quick. But this is ospimifene. It is indicated for moderate to severe dyspareunia associated with menopause. So that vaginal pain associated with menopause. And then your prasterone here, which is the vaginal DHEA or vaginal prasterone. Prasterone is just the name of DHEA when it's made synthetically. So it's a DHEA vaginal suppository, and that's FDA approved for the treatment of moderate to severe dyspareunia associated with vulvovaginal atrophy or genitourinary symptoms of menopause, like Heather was talking about. And then, of course, I just like this little vaginal estrogens chart. I just think it's easy to read. It's kind of one of those print out and fold it up and put it in your pocket type of thing, because it has the dosing and everything on there. I love this slide, and it's because it just gives you a visual of how important estrogen is in the woman's body. And we all know this, and I know you guys probably know this as providers and seeing women in your practice, but just at that final menstrual period line, you can just see that as serum estradiol is dropping in the woman's body and sort of bottoming out after when you get into menopause, when you fully get into menopause, that dyspareunia domain score in the blue, it shoots up. I mean, as soon as your estrogen has bottomed out, you are having the dyspareunia, the vaginal pain, those vulvovaginal atrophy, genitourinary symptoms of menopause. Your women are going to be asking for help. So we are just trying to equip you. So estrogen till death do you part vaginally.
So I think it's also important, again, to talk about just other options. You cannot do female sexual health with a one lens. It's very multifocal, biopsychosocial, if you think back to that early slide. You may have to mention to your patients about different types of sex counseling or therapy options that are out there, some mindfulness-based type of things, sensate focus, things that may not be in your repertoire to give them, but know who your referrals are and where to send them. I'm also going to greatly encourage you to find a pelvic floor physical therapist that you can trust in your arsenal. It is the best thing to help these women. A lot of times, low desire kind of goes neck and neck with oftentimes a sexual pain component too, which these women may have a hypertonic pelvic floor, that meaning everything is held so tightly and they're in a lot of pain. So pain, again, what's going to win that scale, sex or pain? No, I'm not going to have sex because it hurts too much. So it decreases the desire. So again, a very multifocal, multi-lens approach. There's lasers if you have them in your arsenal or know where to send them. There's supplements, moisturizers, lubricants. We're going to show you a couple just last minute slides on that as well. You can jump right over to that next slide since I mentioned lubricants. Different kinds of lubricants. Make sure that you're asking your patient, are you using lubricants when you are having different types of sexual encounters? It doesn't necessarily just have to be for penetrative sex. This could be if it's masturbation, fingers, anything of that nature, especially when you think about your postmenopausal patients that probably may not be lubricating as well. There are so many different kinds of lubricants that are out there. So water-based, petrolatum-based, natural, silicone, all the different ones. I love having this slide on here with a little chart just so that you can refer to it and make sure that you ask them that question.
And then the moisturizers are completely different. Please don't get the two, you know, confused lubricants and moisturizers, but these are just having for actually for vaginal moisturization. They have different osmolalities than the lubricants do. So I just wanted to include this slide just in case you wanted to refer back to it. So, okay, I think we're done. I'll go over the key takeaways. I think the biggest ones here for you to go home with at the end of the day is that FSD is complex and multifaceted disorder with a wide array of symptoms and severity, that biopsychosocial model, that circular Basson's model of the sexual response cycle. The need for treatment options has increased in the recent years. We're getting more, we're doing good, we're getting there. And so pharmacists and nurses and nurse practitioners, mid-levels, doctors, everybody, we all need to be educated on these available drugs and therapies because our patients are going to be asking about them and we want to be properly equipped with an arsenal of things to provide information for them. There are commercially available treatments for HSDD, including flibanserin, bremelanotide, bupropion, and testosterone. Bupropion and testosterone off-label, but available. And then commercially available treatments for vulvovaginal atrophy or genitourinary symptoms of menopause, like ospemifene, prasterone, which is DHEA, and the local estrogens. So that is all we have for you today. We appreciate your time and we thank you so much. We hope you learned something new. I'm sure you took away one tidbit of information, hopefully more than that, but thank you so much for being here. Here's our contact information. Should you have any questions afterwards or how to reach us socially, we also love to share information there. Heather, do you have any closing remarks?
No, thank you again so much for having us. Again, the most important thing I can tell you to take away is just get comfortable, ask the questions, get a little uncomfortable, have it on your intake questionnaire just to kind of know what you're walking into. And you always got to have your token pharmacist because I know I love mine.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening to the Just Ask podcast. Feel free to contact us publicly or privately with your questions and thoughts. This podcast is solely for educational, informational, and entertainment purposes only. We are healthcare providers, but we do not provide direct medical advice in this format, nor do any of our guests of the podcast. But we can point you in the right direction and provide resources. If you want to dig deeper with us, check out the Hive Collective and our 2.5-hour Navigating Menopause and Midlife series, where we talk to you about all the things surrounding your midlife health and how to navigate your journey with your health practitioner.
Use the information in this podcast at your own risk and discretion. You can learn more about the topics we discussed in this episode by viewing the show notes and following us at Just Ask Hive on Facebook and Instagram. Our podcast is available on all of your favorite platforms. Please make sure to subscribe to this show so you never miss an episode. If you found value in this discussion, please share this podcast with friends and leave a rating on iTunes. Thanks again for listening, and never feel afraid to just ask. See you next time.